It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Commerce, a noun, the activity of buying and selling, especially on a large scale. That is what the dictionary will tell you. Us? We just asked the Secretary of Commerce about her job. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 15th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It turns out next week is going to be Infrastructure Week, folks. That's when Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said this morning that he is going to start the actual voting process for the first of two big infrastructure packages the White House wants to get done. $1.2 trillion is the price tag on the first one, $3.5 on the second one. And in a way, if you stop to think about it, that is how much money the White House and at least some Democrats in Congress think it takes to make this economy run the way it ought to. So we got Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo on the phone to talk infrastructure and supply chains and what this economy needs to be able to do what they want it to. Madam Secretary, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let me climb right in with the news of the day. A tidbit from the Federal Reserve this morning about factory production, and I'll just read you the first sentence from Bloomberg. Output of U.S. factories unexpectedly declined in June against a backdrop of persistent supply shortages and soaring materials costs. You're in charge now. Infrastructure's your thing. What's the plan?
Yes. So, listen, we have a serious disruption in a lot of our supply chains, which we shouldn't be surprised by, right? Because a year ago during COVID, we essentially shut the economy down, and now we're trying to open it back up again. So we are doing everything we know how to do to reopen the economy and increase supply, which, by the way, will also bring down prices. I know folks are talking about inflation, so we got to increase supply to bring down prices.
You have said that our supply chains make us vulnerable, that it is a national security risk. They are, because there's more than one supply chain, a national security risk and an economic security risk.
I think that's right. Specifically around semiconductors. Mm-hmm. You know, everything we do, everything digital requires semiconductors, everything. And we don't make enough semiconductors in America. We actually don't make any of the most sophisticated semiconductors. And so absolutely, we are vulnerable. So right now, before Congress, is a proposal to make a $52 billion investment in the semiconductor industry in America.
Is that enough, do you think?
I think it's a fantastic beginning. And yes, it is enough. It's enough to stimulate production of chips in America. And oh, by the way, create a lot of jobs doing it.
Let's talk for a second about the infrastructure plans that are moving through Congress. I'm sure you saw in your packet of briefing materials that you got this morning, as I'm sure every cabinet secretary gets, that Senator Schumer is going to put the first package, the bipartisan package, on the floor of the Senate, I think, next week. It occurs to me that look, $4.5 trillion all in on both packages is a whole lot of money. Is it enough?
It's an excellent question. So first of all, that's great news. Secondly, this, whatever comes out Wednesday and thereafter, is a product of compromise. So it is not all that the president proposed, but it's, you know, multi-trillions of dollars. It will be the biggest bipartisan infrastructure bill ever in our country's history. So I, yes, if we're able to land the plane mm-hmm. on these packages, it'll be a great day in America.
I want to talk about the second half of the Biden administration's infrastructure plan. There is the hard infrastructure plan, the bipartisan plan, including, you know, roads, bridges, broadband of concern to you specifically in your portfolio, but also the $3.5 trillion plan that is geared toward what has come to be called the care economy. And you have said, look, competitiveness is my remit here at Commerce. And if we don't do the care economy right, we're not going to be competitive. So I guess my question, and it follows on the question about whether or not $4.5 trillion is enough money all in, what happens if we don't get the care economy right?
That will be devastating. Devastating to the millions of women who work in the care economy, many of whom work full-time and are poor because they make so little. It will be devastating to the millions of working women who won't be able to participate in the labor market because they can't find care for their sick and elderly parents or their kids. Every other major country has paid family leave, universal public pre-K, a better system of caring for elderly loved ones in their home. We don't. We're behind. It makes us uncompetitive as a nation. And as you know, as you've talked about, women just got crushed during COVID, dropped out of the labor force like nothing we've ever seen. Millions are still out of the labor force. And I don't know your personal situation, Kai, but I have a 90-year-old mother.
Yeah.
She's wheelchair bound. Doesn't want to be in a nursing home, shouldn't be in a nursing home. And so we have a care team for her. And it's even with an awesome care team, it's still really hard to get it all together. But my brother is at work as a doctor, my sister's a college professor, and I'm in the cabinet. And that's like necessary.
Yeah.
Well, for what we can do.
So let me ask you this, just as on the way out here. You're a woman with an incredibly high-powered job that takes probably 26 out of every 24 hours of the day, how much of your time and mental, right? I mean, come on, it's true, right? How much of your time and mental energy do you spend thinking about your mom and then, you know, translate that down to a woman making less than a minimum wage trying to get by, you know?
I know. Honestly, I do not know how women do it. It's a daily, every day, you spend some time thinking about it or trying to coordinate care or doing something. And I am super, super lucky. And by the way, think about the women who provide the care.
Yep.
You know, we have to take care of them because they take care of our loved ones. And they're, you know, they're making like $11 an hour with no sick leave. It's a very vulnerable system. And I hope that Congress can shore it up and get something done.
Gina Raimondo, she's the Secretary of Commerce. Madam Secretary, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As long as we're on jobs, as the Secretary and I were there at the end, this being Thursday, we got our regular update on first-time claims for unemployment benefits this morning. A new low for the pandemic. Last week, 360,000 people applied for jobless benefits for the first time. Once you get past that first application, though, you fall into the continuing claims bucket. That number was down as well, but still more than 3.2 million people are applying every single week in this economy for jobless benefits. Catherine Ann Edwards is a labor economist at RAND. We asked her what that number means to her.
So I look at this number and think that we are basically on a deadline for these workers to find a new source of employment. And one interpretation is that's just the matter of the labor market producing a job. But the other interpretation is that's also a matter of the person feeling comfortable going back to work or being able to go back to work in the pandemic. And so both of these things need to happen.
That deadline she mentioned at the beginning of that cut is this. You file continuing claims for unemployment benefits long enough, eventually you fall into the long-term unemployed category, out of work 27 weeks or more. And as we've talked about, that just makes it all the harder to get back into the workforce. Nothing good happens. On Wall Street today, it was calm by the close. Kind of choppy getting there, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This next story comes with a reminder that this is, in fact, a global economy, and sometimes we are just along for the ride. Topic A today, China. After a first quarter growth of a mind-boggling 18.3%, and yes, a grain of salt with Chinese economic figures is always appropriate, but after that Q1, Beijing said today that second quarter growth was a still robust but less than half of what it was, 7.9%. Now, that is as compared to last year, which, as we all know, was globally terrible. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, news of China perhaps hitting some economic speed bumps is causing some consternation here.
When you're the world's number two economy and you slow down, it matters, says Cornell China expert Ishwar Prasad.
And that's because China has played an outsized role driving global growth since the global financial crisis.
Prasad says while China's economy has slowed from earlier this year,
8% growth by any standards is still remarkably strong.
But China does face significant challenges emerging from the pandemic, including, says Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute, more pandemic.
This Delta variant is spreading like wildfire in Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, as it is in China.
After a slow start, China is stepping up vaccination.
A million a day, but there are a lot of people in China, so it'll take a while.
All of which is slowing trade within Asia. Huffbauer says China faces problems with dodgy bank loans and wasteful public works projects. Meanwhile, the U.S.-China trade war and supply chain disruptions have led to decoupling of the two giant economies, says Columbia political economist Sharon O'Halloran.
Companies housed in the U.S. are actually looking for alternative hubs of production. So that's going to lead to a decline in Chinese growth.
Gary Huffbauer says bilateral trade is down about 15%.
The U.S. lost some exports. China lost some exports. The trajectory is not for much growth going forward.
There's still a lot of stuff going back and forth. Hog feed and chicken wings and lawn furniture and car parts, which matters to U.S. farmers and companies and consumers, but maybe a little less than it used to. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A real estate data and information company, Atom Data, it's called, said today that pandemic or no, foreclosure filings for the first 6 months of this year are down 61% from the same time a year ago, down 78% from 2 years ago, which, good. But the percentage of homeowners 90 days or more behind on their mortgages is more than double what it was early last year. So Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reads the real estate tea leaves for us.
Those unpaid mortgages are called seriously delinquent, and at the last count, nearly 5% of all home mortgages in the U.S. were in that category.
It's elevated for sure.
Susan Wachter studies real estate at the University of Pennsylvania. She says that's not all that unexpected, given the pandemic.
For those who are unemployed, this is a serious problem. Without a job, it's very difficult to pay off that mortgage.
But homeowners who can't pay are not having to foreclose, thanks to the grace period of the moratorium. And there's another reason that this economic moment is different from the Great Recession, says Guy Sakala of Inside Mortgage Finance.
Virtually all the loans outstanding now and the ones we're talking about facing distress or problems are good mortgages.
They're not subprime loans or poorly underwritten, Sakala says.
These aren't borrowers who were given mortgages that they couldn't afford. They weren't putting in houses they couldn't afford.
Back then, home prices tanked and banks needed to offload mortgages quickly. But this housing market is different. Home prices are up, says Gary Painter at the University of Southern California, and people still want to buy. So he says it doesn't make sense for banks to walk away.
They're much better off now thinking about options that keep people paying if they have the ability to pay going forward.
Options like letting homeowners extend their mortgage. For example, you miss 9 months of payments, the bank tacks on an extra 9 months at the back end. Painter still expects some foreclosures.
But I don't think you're going to see a wave of foreclosures like we saw in the Great Recession.
And that's good for homeowners and banks. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
I think Mr. Brancaccio is away for another couple of days. Sabri and the gang are holding down the fort on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Everything you need to know to start your business day. Coming up.
They mean well, but they still do the wrong thing.
So, A for effort then? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 53 points today, about a 10%, 34,987. The NASDAQ down 101, 0.7%, ended things at 14,543. S&P 500 dropped 14 points, about 0.3%, 43.60 there. That report by Amanda Peacher on foreclosures got us thinking about home ownership. A recent report from the property website Zillow found more younger homeowners plan to move or sell their homes in the next 3 years than older people do. 31% of the sub-40s are considering selling. 21% of people age 40 to 49. Makes sense, right? Kids, jobs, all that good stuff. 25% of homeowners, though, cited concerns about not being able to find or afford a different home as a reason they're considering not moving. So we'll do bonds. We'll do the 30-year this time. I want you to think about this. The government of the United States can borrow money for 30 years and pay 1.92% interest. Think about that for a minute. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you thought Italy beating England in the Euro 2020 final this past weekend was Brexit's final indignity to be visited on the English people, well, indignity though it was by no means the last. The European Union, it turns out, has turned its eye toward film and television, a tension that might wind up with the EU cutting how much British content can appear on TV and streaming services within the 27 European Union countries. For the Europeans, apparently it's a cultural thing. For the Brits, it's a $670 million a year market thing. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
The Brits have been lording it over European TV for decades. Shows like Downton Abbey have won huge audiences on the continent, along with the latest major hit, The Crown.
My name is Elizabeth.
And long live Queen Elizabeth.
But are the Brits about to be dethroned? The cultural dominance of British television in continental Europe is under attack.
It's not only a question of culture, it is also a question of economy.
Jérôme Duchesne, who speaks for French TV producers. Under EU rules, more than 50% of TV airtime must be filled with European content, 30% for the streamers like Amazon and Netflix. British TV shows are not subject to those quotas because they're still defined as European. That no longer makes sense, says Duchesne.
European Union is protecting by rules its industry. Is it normal that after the Brexit, UK works can benefit from this protection? I don't think so.
Brexit changes everything, agrees Juliette Puissard, another French audiovisual representative. Outside the EU, she says, the Brits are now free to act unilaterally and pose an even bigger competitive threat.
Some tax relief could be created and could lead to an unfair competition.
Already, she says, there are signs that the Brits have big ambitions for their audiovisual industry.
Because Boris Johnson has said quite clearly that his intent was to create a Hollywood on Thames.
Puissard and Duchesne fear that continental European producers will be further squeezed in their own home market. But Max Rumney, a British screen sector representative, says there's no case for restricting UK content.
To say that European audiences need protecting against it is, you know, flying in the face of what audiences want to watch.
And on the continent, they want to watch a huge range of British TV shows, from the sublime to the, well, not so sublime, like the 1970s sitcom On the Buses, for example.
Look, I can't drive a bus on an empty stomach.
You can't drive a bus at all, mate, can you?
It's apparently a hit in Lithuania, while the preschool children's cartoon Peppa Pig...
I'm Peppa Pig.
...is highly popular in France. But these shows are exclusively British. Juliet Prissard would like to see the quota applied only to the growing number of Anglo-American productions, which may look British but have the enormous benefit of US financial backing. The Crown, one of the most expensive TV series in history, was an Anglo-American show.
We want a regulation whereby a UK film, when it is considered as European, is a real UK film and not an American film.
Like The Crown, for example.
Yes.
And as for the suggestion that any attempt to curb the sale of UK TV shows in the EU would be payback for Brexit, she denies it.
We don't want to punish the Brits, you know. That's not the idea at all.
But none of this would be happening without Brexit, and as one turbulent encounter in The Crown between Prince Charles and Princess Diana underlined...
Not the woman you married!
I refuse to be blamed any longer for this grotesque misalliance! I wash my hands of it!
Divorce can be messy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Stands are full or close to it in a lot of stadiums and arenas this summer, which, among other things, can mean longer lines for food and snacks, more beer and beverage purchases, and more waste as well. And that, as Emil Moffitt reports now from WABE in Atlanta, is an opportunity.
The NBA season this year gave the Atlanta Hawks a chance to do something different.
Those of you who have been here, maybe you can share some of your best practices and how it is easy for you to break the ice.
Last month, Sophie Armanakian, the Hawks' director of sustainability, led a dozen volunteers, all wearing green T-shirts that say, Zero Waste Squad.
Those of you who are new, we're going to do a quick role play and kind of go over what we are doing.
What they'll be doing is to stand by waste bins, telling fans where to toss the compostable cups, food trays, plates, forks, and spoons that come from concession stands, and how to recycle aluminum beer cans and water bottles. Meanwhile, upstairs, fans start filing through the gates. Even though the compost, recycling, and landfill bins are clearly marked, Armanakian tells volunteers some fans here have a hard time figuring out where things go.
You can tell somebody walks up and they see the thing that says plastic bottles and cans, and they're holding a compostable cup that looks like plastic. They're like, huh, and they mean well, but they still do the wrong thing. That's what we're here for.
On a night like this, fans at the sold-out arena will produce nearly 14 tons of waste. And Armanakian says the Hawks' goal is to have at least 90% of that waste go somewhere other than a landfill. And they're not the only ones. Pro sports leagues around the country have developed sustainability programs in the past decade. Baseball even gives out the Green Glove Award to the team that does the most to protect the environment. It's an honor that the San Francisco Giants have won nearly every year. That's no surprise, says environmental consultant Alan Hershkowitz, who works with a number of sports teams and leagues.
You know, the composting infrastructure in San Francisco is very different than the composting infrastructure in Dallas or Kansas City.
And as more sports teams and venues look to stock their concession stands with biodegradable products, more manufacturers, including one based in Georgia, are making them a priority. WinCup recently inked deals with Women's Pro Golf and the concessionaire Delaware North to provide plant-based straws and drink stirrers. Company president Michael Winter says WinCup is investing in the research and development of more sustainable products because that's where he sees future demand.
Where are consumers going to be going to in the years and the months to come? Where can we take this company to bring environmental and sustainable solutions?
Back at the Hawks game, a fan drops an aluminum beer bottle in the recycling bin, earning him praise from James Baskin Jr., one of the Zero Waste Squad volunteers.
We just want to say thank you. We're trying to promote recycling within the arena. Okay, you did a good thing, man.
The fan is rewarded with some Hawks gear and a photo that the team will share on social media in hopes that reducing waste at sporting events continues to catch on. In Atlanta, I'm Emil Moffitt for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Facebook takes a page from Amazon's book. This was yesterday, to be honest with you, but I missed it. The social network has filed a brief with the Federal Trade Commission, just like Amazon did a couple of weeks ago, saying brand new FTC chair Lina Khan should recuse herself from any decisions involving the company. Khan has been, as we've told you, a sharp critic of big tech in her academic writings and previous stints in government. As with Amazon, I'm going to take the under here that she actually does recuse. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic, well, it's not really context as much as it is brand awareness. Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian was asked by the Wall Street Journal about the new virus mutation that's leading to all the new infections. We just call it the variant, said the guy who runs Delta Airlines. I thought that was pretty good. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.